Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork.
We are at the 2025 NATA convention with Jamie Musler. Jamie is a dear colleague, a mentor, a friend of mine. Jamie, welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about what legislative law is?
Yeah. So, you know, law is a kind of a multifaceted issue, particularly in healthcare and athletic training. So legislative law are those rules that are created through the political process, creating a bill, someone passes a bill. Because it's grounded in the legislative process, generally, it's not the best piece of written information, but it's the foundation. It's kind of the lowest level in the sense that all the other regulations are built upon that. And hopefully, by the time it gets done and by the time we're able to practice, it all kind of makes sense.
The American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery has a big lobbying board of orthopedic surgeons who are essentially battling the government committees that be that are trying to, you know, reduce reimbursements and essentially make an orthopedic surgeon's life more difficult and getting in the way of patient care. So orthopedic surgeons are advocating for, you know, more transparency, better patient care, et cetera. So when you and your profession are advocating for the betterment of allied health professionals, and then down the line, obviously, the betterment of patient care, who are you lobbying or advocating against, I guess? I guess who's pushing back against you and who's making the final decision? Because even as a huge group of orthopedic surgeons, we still feel outnumbered by the government who are not healthcare professionals. They're just lawyers who are saying, you know, we don't care how much you want to get paid. We don't care how long you've trained. We don't care how much debt you're in. You know, we just kind of want to do this to you anyway. So do you have that same issue?
Absolutely. You know, the political process, whether it's, you know, local at a municipality, whether it's state or federal government, it's the same basic process. You know, the intent is checks and balances to make sure nothing runs rogue. But at all levels, at the fundamental piece is money. You know, it's pay to play. Whether you're, you know, a well-funded lobbyist like the orthopedic surgeons or a less than well-funded lobbyist like athletic trainers, you're at the Hill, you're educating, you're trying to get people to make the decision for the right reasons. The other side of that process is you have a political entity that's concerned with being reelected. Who's going to like me for doing this? Who's not going to like me for doing it? And that's what they're trying to navigate. Very often these bills, whether they're federal or state, you know, they go through a number of committees, and the committees are made up of political entities, legislators that all have their own agendas. They have their own people that are funding them. Very often there's opposition. Some are Republican, some are Democrats. And ultimately they have to decide, is this something that has value? What's its impact on them personally in their political careers, but also the public? I mean, ultimately, they're charged with protecting the public. And you hope that that's the reason why things happen. But I think more often than not, when you hear people that do this for a living, it comes down to money. You know, who's paying who, who's donating, who's in whose pockets. And it really helps to build friendships and relationships and have legislators that support you. But in the end, it has to go through that kind of sausage-making process.
Yeah.
And come out that committee. And even if you put a bill forward that's supported, by the time it comes out, it's going to be changed. And it's not unusual to have something that's intended to be positive, whether it's for the orthopedic surgeons or the athletic trainers. And then when it finally passes, it was, oh my God, you know, what happened? And it doesn't look like it originally did. And I think you're right that the reasons entities move forward, groups move forward, whether it's athletic trainers or orthopedic surgeons, is for the right reasons. You know, it's generally to improve healthcare, improve quality of their lives. But there's always someone on the other side that has a different opinion.
Our live series at the NATA convention is sponsored by MetOne Technologies. Looking for innovation in orthopedics? Meet the only U.S.-based, Latin-owned manufacturer originally focused on spinal implants, now leading the way in upper and lower extremity solutions. They've just expanded their portfolio with the newly launched Fortis Distal Radius Plating System, 510K cleared and designed for next-level performance. This isn't just progress, it's representation, precision, and results, all in one. Today's episode is sponsored by Get Raw, a potent antioxidant blend made with all raw organic ingredients. The Get Raw Ginger Turmeric formulation is 200 to 300 times more bioavailable to the human body. Documented benefits include decreased inflammation, improved digestion, immunity, cognition, and more. Get healthy, get well, get raw, the organic wellness shot.
How do you think we change the process of regulation or legislation? Two different things, but how do you change that to become a faster process? Because that seems like you said that that key word was by the time it comes out, a key phrase, it's changed, or you're redlined, you're changing whatever it is. How do we make that a faster process to benefit the healthcare provider?
Do you have the magic wand to make legislation faster?
You know,
that was a better way to phrase it.
Constitution was created years ago and it ain't going to change, right?
That's
right.
True.
By design, you know, it's there are multiple entities and it's a negotiation and it will never change.
Yeah.
I think as we were talking about a little bit earlier, structuring things the way they're intended would help. As an example, if the legislation, the bill that's passed by the government is broad-based, charging a smaller entity, part of the administrative branch, the Board of Medicine, the Board of Athletic Training, to develop the regulations, that's more nimble. Those boards also can create policies that don't have to follow the regulatory change process. So even regulations has to go through an approval process. And that's cumbersome. It's government. You know, it's government employees, it's agencies. But building it kind of open and putting the authority and the power in the right places, I think would help. I don't think it's worth listing.
Do you think our governing body has the ability to kind of reboot that across the country? Because do you think that's an issue where the language is there, but is the foundation where it needs to be?
So when you say our governing body,
the NATA.
The NATA, right. So, you know, healthcare is regulated at the local level. It's funded federally, in some cases, funded state. But in general, those decisions, those practice decisions are local, it's state-based.
Yeah.
And the legislative process is state-based. So everyone is so different. Some disciplines have used model language to bring consistency. And when a number of states go to change their statutory language, they do it based on model language to kind of bring some commonality across all the states. We haven't done that.
Yeah.
At least not successfully.
Yeah.
So the BOC has put forward model language over the last few years. It hasn't been adopted on a broad level by the NATA and pushed out to the states. So, you know, there is that inconsistency. I think if you could bring some consistency to it, you know, the definition of athletic training and the definition of athletic training, you could potentially make things easier.
Yeah.
But you could also argue that having those definitions not in the statutory language would be the best thing. Have that be charged to the state boards, which are much more nimble and could actually update the language when needed.
Do you think the role of athletic training today, if you're a young athletic training student or a young athletic training professional, do you think the role of an athletic trainer is expanding, contracting, or staying the same?
100% expanding.
Okay.
You know, and that's a challenge, right? I would say, you know, when I entered the profession, you know, the vast majority of athletic trainers were college, high school, professional sports. The first expansion I remember hearing about was moving into more traditional healthcare settings, the private clinics, hospitals, and then you start hearing about industrial medicine and military. So it's definitely expanding, and it's expanding because there's incredible value to our skill set. The challenge is, and this is what we see in Massachusetts, that original definition from 30 years ago defined athletic training and what an athlete is. And it makes it difficult for an athletic trainer in Massachusetts to work in the industrial setting. because it doesn't meet the pure definition of what an athlete is based on the legislation. So it's really restricting employment. And in this day and age, you know, that's a challenge.
We do talk about the different disciplines or where you're going to be, you know, employment opportunities are. And you said it, language, like it's how do we broad stroke it so it actually helps to benefit the people we're working for or with. And I always say they're industrial athletes. Everybody's an athlete. Everybody wants to get back to whatever their life is. If you're a stay-at-home mom, you're still an athlete. You're helping make your family be able to do what they can do and you can help your family. So can we change that? And does it come down to the word athletic trainer, right? And I think you and I have had this conversation before. Is that something we have to go back to and start from the basics? And is that something that's realistic?
So, you know, the first thing I learned when I was studying law was, you know, law is just an interpretation of words.
Yeah.
Right. So when you have a definition of athlete that is practices to participate in athletic activities, well, does a housewife do that? Does someone working on an assembly line do that? That's a definition that is fairly narrow. An athlete is also someone that plans for and participates in physical activity.
Yeah.
Much broader definition. So if we are able to change those definitions that are in statute or in regulations to be broader, it certainly opens up a pool of patients that otherwise wouldn't be there. As we were talking about earlier, though, there may be disciplines that don't want us to have access to a broader pool of patients because they feel it's competition, or that maybe we're not qualified. You know, the thing I hear a lot is, oh, you're only trained to deal with healthy people that are injured. You know, what if they have cancer? What if they have, you know, some other medical condition that you're not trained in? Well, you and I know we're trained in broad aspects of care. And while we're not an expert in every particular detail, we certainly are trained to identify and get it to the right person if it's outside of us.
Correct.
Yeah, it's not a one size fits all. And I was talking to a functional medicine doctor a little bit earlier today at the convention, and athletic training has an enormous role, not only for healthy people who get injured, but sick people who get injured or sick people in general. And you're 100% right. Your training is expansive enough to know that, okay, if someone has cancer, for example, you're not the person they're going to be seeing primarily, but you could absolutely have a positive impact on their life. And that's why I think cross-discipline collaboration is so important. And that's why I like the Venn diagram example of allied health professionals, where people can overstep their boxes or their areas of expertise and to collaborate just to make patient care better. And it sounds like that's something you're a big advocate
for. Absolutely. You know, I've always preached there's no ego in healthcare, right?
Well,
no, there is.
Well, there's a lot of ego in healthcare, but you have to minimize your ego to the best of your ability.
Yeah. So, you know, recognizing that I know a little bit about something. I know enough to know what it is, but get it to the expert. Mm-hmm. You know, way back when Andrew was working with me at Curry College, small Division III school, but our care team had 16 different experts in there. We had neurologists, orthopedic surgeon, foot guys, shoulder guys. We had physical therapists. You know, not because I wasn't good at all of those, but because I was good at all of those doesn't mean there isn't someone better at any particular piece.
Of course.
So I think all of that plays into it. I think what holds us back, though, is the ego of the provider, ego of the discipline that says, no, I'm the one. And that's a turf war. You were mentioning, you know, this collaborative process. And one of the great strengths of athletic trainers is we see our patients far before they get to the traditional healthcare system. We're the original primary care provider. We're seeing them, we're in the schools. We have that opportunity to see that potential outlier, the cancer, the unusual thing, far earlier than it probably would be seen at the next physical exam or 2 years later when it actually starts to hurt. So that has to be part of our education, provided it's supported with this understanding that, you know, there are other people out there that have to be part of your care team.
Yeah, and having that connection, I know Riz and Dr. Gill have had that connection for over 20 years. And although Riz and I don't technically work together, we still talk all the time, and I'm in Arizona and he's in Boston, but he can evaluate the athlete immediately. And then if it needs the care of an orthopedic surgeon, getting it to the orthopedic surgeon and then being able to continue the care non-operatively or operatively and then in the rehab process, I think is completely invaluable.
Absolutely. It's fundamental to the athletic trainer's practice. And I think it's probably the greatest challenge for many athletic trainers, particularly those that are working at high schools. You know, I think there's a misconception that if you have a physician, an orthopedic surgeon, a team physician that wants to see your patients, that he's supervising your practice. And that's not always the case.
Supervising your athletic training practice?
Correct. Which in many states is the requirement. Mm-hmm. That supervising physician takes responsibility for your practice. We work under the direction of, in most states, a physician. And that direction has to be clear and defined. It can be standing orders. It can be verbal at times. On occasion, athletic trainers, when their practice is questioned, they say, well, my physician said I could do that. Well, they ask the physician. It's like, oh, geez, you know, I'm not sure, I would support that. That needs to be that very tight, close relationship, both personally from a communication standpoint, like you were saying, to kind of bounce things off of. But I would argue that it needs to be contractual too, on both sides, because you're both taking on risks. And that's something that is harder and harder for athletic trainers to come by.
Yeah.
One, you know, there's less value to teen physicians working with high schools and small colleges than there used to be, you know, partly because of insurance, partly because of other, you know, limitations to practice. And that makes it hard for athletic trainers to kind of do their job.
And when I first started, we developed that relationship, Dr. Gill and myself, some 20 plus years ago. That was our first initiative, is, okay, let's make sure that we're all on the same page, what the direction is going to be, how we're going to care for athletes, what the referrals are going to look like if we're referring. So there is that communication, that understanding, like that you can provide X because you're educated and able to do that. And again, it's that relationship you're building with your standing physician. And then the key is to have a multimodal approach, like Cameron mentioned, like that step over where you can work with other people within the industry, because you're doing right by the patient. You're trying to provide, like you had mentioned, hey, this patient, I think, has had back pain at night. It's not characteristic. They should have not back pain at night. Let's get them in to see someone that can actually look at this further, where this could be missed and not picked up for 3, 4, 5 months. That's not good. So the athletic trainer is definitely the key person in that care team.
Well, and as old as you are, you know, when you and Gil got together.
I'm still 25,
you
know, man.
You didn't have standing orders.
The same as he did 20 years ago.
You didn't have standing orders. You didn't have standardized procedures. You didn't have to worry about practicing in the gray areas, because there really weren't any. It was
right.
A little bit of people. All that you have to have, right?
Speaking about that, is there any restriction in regards to licensure? And let's just talk about the state of Massachusetts, for instance, because we both work in that state. What are the restrictions to licensure if you're an athletic trainer? Is there, for people that don't understand what the difference between certification and licensure, can you speak a little bit to that and how that works?
Yeah, so licensure is the highest level of regulation for a discipline. Certification is next level down. And then things like registration are below that. So in Massachusetts, and the profession of athletic training has been lobbying and trying to get legislation passed to license athletic trainers in all states. And that's been kind of the advancement of the profession. Licensure establishes educational requirements. It establishes some practice standards. Very often it'll establish continuing education, continuing competency requirements, all intended to protect the public. Certification is kind of the entry bar. You pass something, an exam, a test, to be certified, and it says you've met the minimum standard, and you have to maintain that standard. But it doesn't necessarily provide boundaries or scope issues, although the BOC does provide some language that creates certain aspects of scope for the athletic trainer. So different levels. Licensure, as I mentioned, is the highest level of regulation.
And how does the state regulate that? So meaning, if you're licensed, how long do you have your license for? Do you have to renew the license? Is there regulation on the athlete? How do you track if they're licensed or not? And that's, I think, a key understanding of how that works, because I know that when you apply for something, it's not forever. How does it work in the state of Massachusetts?
So in Massachusetts, the Board of Allied Health regulates and credentials, licenses, the ATs, PTs, and OTs, and PT assistants and OTs, and certified occupational therapy assistants. And it's the board is housed under the Board of Health, Massachusetts Department of Public Health. And it's a 2-year credential. Every 2 years, you have to fill out an application, reapply. For athletic trainers, the regulatory language for our continuing education is tied to the BOC requirements for continuing education. So as long as you maintain your credentials as being a certified athletic trainer, that would satisfy the state requirements for continuing education.
And what is the BOC's standard for us? Is it how many CEUs would you say?
I think it's 50 quarter reporting.
I think so. Yeah,
40
yeah.
to 50.
So we still have to have that. That's outside of the mass state.
So,
okay.
Yes. So the other two disciplines in mass, it's board regulated.
Yeah.
And it's far more ambiguous and I argue lenient. There's a whole list of things that qualify for continuing education.
Yeah.
And the other disciplines that probably we wouldn't work for the BOC.
Yeah.
In addition, in Massachusetts, when they created the continuing education requirements for PT and OT, which was, I think, 2 years ago, they had some requirements that we didn't have through the BOC. So those were added to ours. So we have to have at least one credit in law and one credit in
ethics,
which is added on to our BOC.
Yeah, I think it's three total, I think. Ethics, law, and
I think it's
jurisprudence?
Two.
Is it the two? Okay.
Just the two, yeah. So when we go and get our BOC and we're taking our CEUs to meet that requirement, we just have to be sure that two of those credits, one is in law and one is in ethics.
And is there a licensing police that comes out and arrests you if you don't comply? How does that work?
Yes and no. I mean, when you fill out a renewal form or an application, you sign an affidavit that you have things.
Yep.
When you're originally credentialed, you have to submit all this paperwork. Yeah. There's an agency that reviews, make sure you went to an accredited program, you passed your BOC, you have your CPR, make sure you don't have any felon, you know, background checks, all that stuff.
Yeah, we don't need any felons.
Right. Although we see some of them.
Yeah, you do. We actually do. It's crazy the stuff that we see. I was going to use another word, but I said stuff.
Actually, the vast majority of things.
Well, we could, but yeah, I was trying to keep it clean.
You can swear on this part.
The vast majority of complaints are not for athletic painters.
No.
But there are some crazy dudes out there.
We can go down the whole wormhole of that.
I love it. Well, you're on the Committee of Professional Ethics here at the NATA. So what are some of the ethical challenges that you see as a committee member?
It's, you know, a lot of it in the last 5 years is social media, inappropriate conduct, relationships, underage people.
Taking pictures of people?
It's not the subtle practice things. It's the things that clearly are not appropriate. And so we had a committee meeting yesterday, a national committee meeting, and some of the things we're talking about is, how do you educate the profession to make sure they understand what the ethical issues are, the code of ethics, the standards within the discipline? But I argue that the people that we see that have complaints know what they're doing is wrong. It's not that they don't understand it's not ethical to sleep with a minor. It's that they're making bad choices.
And they think they can get away with it?
You know, that's the part it's hard to figure out. You know, when you interview them and you talk to them, there are all sorts of things that go through people's mind. In my opinion, the money and sex kind of drive bad decisions.
It drives human behavior.
Yeah, 100%. And it's all wrapped up in that. It's, well, I knew I shouldn't, but. And, you know, that's where you lose your career, you know. And I'm not sure, you know, beefing up content in our academic programs is going to change that. I've never had someone that I interviewed or we investigate as part of a judicial panel that said, oh, geez, I didn't know that giving one of my athletes a case of beer was wrong.
Misinformation.
Sorry, that was misinformation. This is a podcast not about misinformation. Right. I apologize. It is misinformation.
There's a balance between factual and banter.
It's true. Now, when you got out of college, yes, we went out and had it.
Yeah, when I was 21 plus. Right. Riz and I have shared some beers.
We've also, too, you know, I mentioned kind of the social media thing. I think one of the difficult things to navigate is communication. You know, I think it's not unusual now for some athletic trainers to communicate with their athletes through text messages, through these informal things. But, you know, no good can come of it. You know, it really, and even amongst colleagues, you know, we see cases where so-and-so, you know, one of my patients said this, and they text it to another, hey, can you believe that? You know, this is what you told me today. And somehow, you know, the net expands and word gets out. Next thing you know, the person finds out that you commented about them, and It started as a simple text, and now there are six people that had an ethics violation because they received the text.
How do you think your ethics position for the NATA has helped your board position for the Board of Allied Health, being the chairman of that board?
There's a lot of overlap in process, although they're very different. I think a combination of the work I've done on the Committee for Professional Ethics, my background in law, my law degree, my doctorate in law, and our actions at the board in investigating really have taught me how to look at a violation, how to evaluate it. It's really not about whether someone broke the law. It's about what is that code, what is the specific standard that the NATA Code of Ethics or the Board of Allied Health Code of Ethics, which are the same, by the way, say, and did the person violate that? Something can be unethical but legal, and that can be challenging. So I think just how I think about evaluating the case is really changed through the work of all three of those speeches.
Yeah, I mean, you and I have chatted a bunch, and just sitting on the board with you, I've learned a lot about the ethics piece, you know, that, and we all know what's right and what's wrong. But when we see some of these cases that come through, like just seeing you methodically go through and help educate the board, because most people are the law piece that just, it's a lot to understand. But I think your experience has been valuable for me to understand it a little bit more. So I have a better understanding when we're talking about certain cases, but also, when I went and did my CEs for ethics, all that stuff that I learned or went over is like stuff that we have chatted and gone over anyway. So it's actually a bit really nice overlap.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you saying that. You know, it is a hard thing. You know, ethics is very difficult to define, you know, and, you know, I think there was an old definition of porn, which is you can't define it, but you know what it is when you see it.
You know what it is when you see it.
Yeah. 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 I think there's some of that to ethics too, you know, and so much of it is grounded in societal behaviors and beliefs and upbringing and your morals and values. And to some extent, it is a moving target. Yeah. Different people could have different ethical values. The challenge is, can a profession set clear boundaries that establishes the ethics of that discipline? You know, personal ethics aside, we have to maintain in our profession, athletic training, that there is a standard there that we all abide by.
So including ethics, how do you encourage athletic trainers or allied health professionals to advocate or work with the legislative board to make things better for the allied health professionals and at the end of the day, better for the patients?
Yeah, and this goes back to kind of what we were talking about a little bit earlier. You know, being a political process, the politicians are looking at every issue and saying, what does it mean to me? And when they get a call on a bill from three people, it's less impactful. When they get a call on a bill from 15,000 people, you know, all athletic trainers, all orthopedic surgeons, they're like, all right, so how many of those are actually in my voting district and can vote for me or against me? And they balance these issues. Difficult issues can move very quickly if there's support and the legislators feel that it could impact their careers. On the other hand, very important issues that seem to be less impactful to them, they sit there forever. And I think that's been a challenge for athletic training. You know, we've been trying to change our statutory language for 20 plus, 25
years. Anyway, yeah.
And we can't get out of committee. We're a small profession. We're not well-funded. And when push comes to shove, there are disciplines that are much bigger and a louder voice that can swoop in at the last minute and oppose something.
But what levers do you think we can pull as athlete trainers to get the rest of the community in the athlete training community to be able to advocate for those things that come up? Like how do we make it top of mind in order to get those things taken care of?
You know, I think we do all the things, you know, every discipline does. You go to meet and greets, you donate money, you go to state house days, you invite them to your clinics, you invite them to your high schools, you honor them at conventions and meetings. My personal feeling is it doesn't change the needle.
Yeah.
There are too many other issues. My mindset has changed considerably. what we've been trying to do in athletic training is attack the problem from the most difficult perspective, changing a law. I'm starting to believe that there are other routes. If you want to have more athletic trainers in high schools because it improves patient care, one way is to change a law and require athletic trainers at high schools. The other is to go to the Department of Ed and say, you require speech language pathologists, you require nurses, you require all of these disciplines at your schools. Why don't you require athletic trainers? So shifting from the legislative branch to the administrative branch of government, still a bureaucracy, but it might be easier to move the needle by dealing with the administrative side as opposed to the legislative one.
So more of like a more of a grassroots where you can then get into like the community as well, though, I think would be a great way to do it.
Yeah, you know, grassroots is always kind of a catchphrase in legislative process. But again, I feel like we've been doing that for 30 years as a profession, and we struggle. So at what point is it time to look at alternatives? Like you bang your head on the wall so many times, at some point you're going to start bleeding and say enough is enough, right? And I'm just wondering if in athletic training, it's time to start focusing on other processes that may be more fruitful to create change.
And I want to go back to this because do you think our title is the issue with a lot of what goes on in requirement in school systems, in secondary school systems? Because when you say athletic trainer, people are like, oh, you tape ankles? Oh, wait, you train athletes? Like, they don't understand the disciplines. So is that a black eye for us as a profession still? Or is that like, where does that come in?
You know, it's not perfect, but I would argue that every discipline, you know, has issues around marketing and education. You know, people don't know what physician assistants are. People don't know what speech language pathologists do. You know, while there's bits and pieces in the name that kind of describe it, I think there is definitely a connotation to athletic training that maybe doesn't put us in the upper echelon of healthcare because of how we evolved, how we came up, the fact that we work hard and take care of a lot of things behind the scenes, which I think probably hurts us.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure the title itself, you know, we can blame. Again, it's not perfect, but, you know, does sports medicine practitioner work better?
Or what's an alternative?
Yeah.
But let's put you on the spot. You're proposing a new name for the athletic
training. Oh, I'm not proposing. I'm just asking.
Just asking. And Jamie Gary gave a great answer. Is there another name that maybe pops in your head?
Well, I mean, Canada is, sports therapists?
Yeah, they might be sports or athletic therapists.
Athletic therapists.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they're athletic therapists.
The PTs get pissed.
You know, in Europe, they're physios.
Yeah.
You know,
when I was a fellow in Switzerland, my faculty mentor was always physio. You know, we would send everyone to physio. My Canadian attendings in residency, physio. It just sounds more distinguished and regal and fancy. And I like saying physio to my patients, even though I'm in Arizona.
What's the big thing for the next generation? Because the one thing that I struggle with, like for us, as I call us the old guys, like with one foot is out, we would work, do what we needed to do to make the profession better, to make our product better, to provide for our athletes. Not saying the younger generations are not doing that. How do we get them more interested in this? And how do we get them more interested in advocating for the profession to get it to go 50 more years in the future?
Wow, you're killing me.
Sorry, I had to give that to you.
It's a great question.
Yeah, it is.
That was actually a well thought out question.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
When I get into athletic training, it was a little bit of a mistake. Not a mistake, but kind of I stumbled into it.
It's
but
because they wouldn't let me in a PT. That's how I got it.
Just to say that.
Sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
Wow, you just set the profession back about 40 years.
Well, now we're named to bring it back into the future. Right. 50.
Oh, we have. I already have.
That's true. Okay.
You know, I developed a passion for it, and I just love being an athletic trainer. But I very early recognized the limitations, and I was motivated to create change. That's how I got into the legislative process, you know, 30 years ago. And it's how I commit time now to volunteering and to trying to change and being on boards and to improve regulation and to expand the profession because it's important to me. As you mentioned, generations look at things differently. I was talking to a colleague yesterday here. He is a volunteer athletic trainer for the Paralympic rugby team, and he's been trying to cultivate his replacement for years. You can't find it because their first question they're asked, how much do I get paid? Do I have to work a 40-hour week? Will I get to go to Europe? And he's like, none of that matters. You know, no to everything, but there's so much reward in it. Different generations have different things, and I do feel like the mindset's different. That's not to say there aren't young athletic trainers that are passionate and want to create change. I don't have the answer to how you cultivate it, right? You mentor the same way you do all social aspects of a profession, and hope recognize that you can't look at something in the moment. You have to look at big picture. If you're just looking in the moment, then you're miserable. We can't do this. We can't do that. This is a problem. This is good today. It won't be good tomorrow. But if you look at how far we've come in 10, 20 years and how far we will advance over the next 10 or 20 years, that gets a little more palatable and a little more exciting. Yeah. There are challenges along the way, but showing that passion, I think.
No, I think that's a great answer. Well, Jamie.
I'm not going to talk about my neck.
Oh, yeah. Oh, let's talk
to you. Yeah, we are at the NATA convention, and you do have a, I don't want to call it funny, interesting, relatable story to the NATA and regarding your neck. You want to share that?
Yeah, sure. You know, and being an orthopedic surgeon, you know, maybe I'll look for some advice here too. But, you know, back towards the end of COVID, the national convention was in Philadelphia. So came down for the convention. Had all of my vaccinations, felt perfectly fine. I think I flew back on Thursday. That Saturday, we were leaving to go on vacation to our house on the Cape. And I get up Saturday morning, we packed the car, we went to the Cape, felt perfectly fine. Sunday morning, I think it was the 4th of July, I was sitting out in the yard having a cup of coffee. My wife yells at me, you gotta make a sandwich, you know, we're going to the beach. So I go into the house, I'm at the island in my kitchen making a bologna sandwich, and next thing you know, I wake up, I'm lying on the ground and I can't move the left side of my body. My daughter was right next to me. She said, you just kind of keeled over, and I slid down the side of the kitchen island, and my head hit the stove, and I dislocated my C2 vertebra. Go to Cape Cod Hospital. Now, I had two spine surgeries previously for stenosis. So I had some fusion at C3, 4, and 5.
It probably saved you.
I don't know. Maybe the lack of mobility caused
I'm not
focal force.
Not a spine surgeon, but you know, you fuse those levels.
Yeah.
The level above is going to be more vulnerable to high energy.
Which was my thinking. The surgeons that said, "Oh, it doesn't work that way," and I'm convinced that it absolutely does. And you know, they weren't 100% clear on things. But so at Cape Cod Hospital, they saw this erector set of a neck, and they're like, "Hey, we ain't touching that. We're sending you back into Boston." So I went into Mass General. Didn't have the surgeon that did my first two, but had a neurosurgeon go in and fix and stabilize the jump facet, and decided at the time that the stenosis was progressing. So we did a complete posterior decompression, replace kind of the muscles with these nice rods and screws. I mean, that was in 2022. And
so have you fused from what level or what level?
2 to 7.
2 to 7.
Yeah, beaker. Yep. And they did a posterior laminectomy, so they took off the whole roof.
Yep.
Wow. How do you feel?
That's solid.
Miserable. And it's not the facet, it's the laminectomy.
I was going to say the laminectomy.
Yeah. You know, I'm back. I play soccer. I play old men's soccer, and I don't head the ball, and I do what I can. But, you know, the idea of doing the laminectomy because of potential, at the time, I felt great. Yeah. My first two surgeries did wonders. They did that to prevent this type of pain down the road, and it caused it. You know, it's tough for me to get my head around. I'm having a tough time getting the surgeon to see me again, so, which is a bit of a hint that maybe something happened. But.
What would your advice be?
So during the workup, I sat in Mass General Trauma Center for about 24 hours because they wouldn't operate until they figured out why I had passed out. And so they did cardiac, they did everything. And
did they think it was vaccine related?
So the only positive test was I was positive for COVID.
Okay.
But I had no symptoms. And at the time, it was new enough where this transient loss of
consciousness
wasn't really in the literature. It came out a little bit later. But bottom line is I broke my neck making a bologna sandwich, man.
And do you still eat bologna to this day?
You know, it took me about 3 years, but just recently I had my first bologna
and
sandwich.
And nothing's happened to your neck since the bologna sandwich?
No, but my son rags me to know that. You sure you want to do that?
Maybe
Dad?
That's the sign to not eat bologna sandwiches.
Right. Yeah, right. All those nitrates.
That's a great story,
Jim. Yeah, thanks for coming on today. Appreciate I value it. Your mentorship and your friendship. I've known you for a lot of years and hopefully a lot more years to come. We value your expertise in the subject. And
happy to do it. You know, I appreciate, you know, the work that you're doing with this podcast and educating the public, and great things are coming.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.